Today is Monday, September 20th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, Australia defends tripartite alliance with the U.S. and the U.K.
Australia said Sunday it regrets France's decision to immediately recall its ambassadors to Canberra and Washington.
Plus, United Nations climate talks gets underway.
Push right now during high-level week here at the UN to get momentum for this conference.
Also, Rwanda court finds the man who inspired, quote, Hotel Rwanda, unquote, guilty of terror-related offenses. Our top story today is around the Korean Peninsula. North Korea has criticized the U.S. decision to provide nuclear-powered submarines to Australia and threatened unspecified countermeasures if it finds the deal affects its security. State media Monday published comments from an unidentified North Korean foreign minister official who called the arrangement between U.S., Britain and Australia an, quote, extremely dangerous move that would destroy the security balance in the Asian Pacific. The official said it would set off a nuclear arms race. The official said the North was closely examining the deal and would proceed accordingly if it has, quote, even a little adverse impact on the security of our country, unquote. The North also said the deal would destroy the peace and stability of the region and the international nuclear non-proliferation system. In a separate statement Monday, the North scoffed at South Korea's recent missile tests, saying the missiles were clumsy and didn't appear ready for military use. Jang Chang-ha, president of North Korea's Academy for National Defense, said the weapon system designed to fire conventionally armed missiles posed no immediate threat to the North. Australia is defending its decision to join a tripartite alliance with the United States and Britain, despite an angry reaction from France. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Australia said Sunday it regrets France's decision to immediately recall its ambassadors to Canberra and Washington in response to a new deal that will make Australia only the seventh country to have nuclear-powered submarines. Australia scrapped a multi-billion dollar defence contract with France after joining the new AUKUS alliance with the US and Britain. It will instead build a new fleet of nuclear-powered submarines with help from the US and the UK. The pact is widely seen as an effort to counter China's influence in the contested South China Sea. Australia wasn't sure the attack-class diesel-powered submarines it ordered from France were up to the job. Prime Minister Scott Morrison said it would have been negligent to go ahead with the deal against advice from Australia's intelligence agencies and its military. Australia's new submarine fleet isn't expected to be in service for decades, and it could lease or buy vessels from the United States or Britain in the meantime. Prime Minister Scott Morrison said the alliance would boost regional security.
This is seen as a positive move that contributes to peace and stability. All countries will invest in their own defence capabilities. Indeed, China does in theirs, and as we know, they've invested heavily in those capabilities.
Australian Defence Minister Peter Dutton Sunday defended Canberra's handling of the multi-billion dollar submarine contract with France, describing his government as upfront, open and honest in its dealings with Paris. France doesn't agree. French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian.
C'est vraiment en bon français un coup dans le dos.
It really is a stab in the back. We built a relationship of trust with Australia, and this trust was betrayed.
The animosity could have wider implications. France said it would be unable to trust Australia in talks on forging a free trade agreement with the European Union, although EU officials have insisted negotiations will continue. Hervé Lemieux is the Director of Research at the Lowy Institute, an independent think tank based in Sydney. He says France's response to the AUKUS alliance was unexpected, but he's urging French President Emmanuel Macron not to overreact.
It's quite unprecedented for France or any country to recall two ambassadors simultaneously from two different countries. France has to be careful not to overplay its hand. Their anger is legitimate and understandable. Understandable, but mustn't be allowed to take control of their foreign policy. It's not clear, for example, that Macron speaks for all of Europe, given the silence from other EU capitals.
Lemieux says that China's military ambitions in the Indo-Pacific region could also face a greater challenge from the new AUKUS alliance.
The Chinese will read it as an escalatory act. There's no question it will escalate great power competition. And now the question is, does it create more stability or less stability? And that will be a key question for other countries in the Indo-Pacific.
China has accused the new alliance partners of having a Cold War mentality. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The 76th session of the United Nations General Assembly is underway, and city officials and residents are girding for the commotion it will bring, along with fears of an increased risk of COVID-19 spread. Tina Trent reports.
The 76th session of the United Nations General Assembly is officially underway, and delegates have returned to UN headquarters in New York City for in-person meetings, with many more expected in the coming days.
We have about 90 heads of state, head of government, that the Secret Service will be protecting, in addition to approximately 40 spouses. So for us, we're in a range of about 130 protectees that are going to be within the city of New York.
The convergence of world leaders will mean an increased security presence, along with blocked roads and checkpoints.
I think it goes without saying there will be some traffic closures and street closures. There will be impact, undoubtedly, but the goal is really to minimize that.
For local residents, routine errands will likely become logistically challenging.
You know, if you go shopping, you need your ID to come back home.
The threat of COVID-19 adds another layer of complication to security efforts. And in the city that once was the epicenter of the pandemic, locals have mixed feelings about this year's massive gathering.
I'm hoping that everybody is vaccinated.
We'll see people again, and the vitality and the economy that needs to be revitalized will be here. But then again, to know that we really might see another surge come, it's very, very, very troubling.
The city says it'll ask all delegates to show proof of vaccination before entering the General Assembly Hall. But UN officials stress they can't ban heads of state from entering UN headquarters, which is international territory, if they're not vaccinated.
We need to balance the need to have world leaders here, have officials who can talk to each other and interact with each other, and balance that against the need to keep social distancing and keep all the preparations in place to deal with COVID-19.
New York City officials are also partnering with the UN to mitigate the threat of COVID-related disruptions.
The city is providing a mobile unit, a mobile van that will provide testing and vaccinations free of cost to all attendees this year.
Given the high-level discussions due to take place, many are hoping to return to in-person interactions after last year's UN General Assembly was almost entirely virtual. With the stage for international diplomacy set, the convergence of world leaders and all the disruption that brings is also a bid for a degree of normalcy. Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
Pressure is building on world leaders to increase their efforts to fight global warming. As the UN General Assembly opens in New York, officials are expecting over 40 world leaders to meet to work towards a more robust effort at tackling climate change. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres and British Prime Minister Boris Johnson are hoping the closed-door session can persuade some countries to do more leading up to global climate talks in Scotland in 6 weeks. For more, I spoke with VOA's UN correspondent Margaret Bashir.
In 6 weeks' time, there will be a big review conference of the Paris Climate Accord, and that's going to happen in Glasgow, Scotland. So there's a big push right now during high-level week here at the UN to get momentum for this conference. Secretary General of the United Nations says we're at a turning point in terms of climate change, that we're not on track to meet the Paris target of containing global warming to less than 1.5 degrees Celsius over pre-industrialized levels. In fact, a new report Friday said that we're on course to hit 2.7 degrees of warming, which would be catastrophic. But the UN's point is that it's not too late to reverse this course. We have 10 years to do it, this decade coming up before 2030. And so there's a big push to get more ambitious commitments from countries, from big emitters like the United States and China and European countries who cause a lot of climate effects because they're big industrialized nations, to get bigger commitments from them to cut their emissions and to put money toward helping poorer countries that aren't contributing so much to climate change, like countries in Africa and the South Pacific, places that are not so industrialized, that are not a big emitters, but who are suffering the effects of climate change. They want them to put money towards that. So we're having a big conference here today. The Secretary General and the Prime Minister of Great Britain, Boris Johnson, are having a private meeting with about 30 key countries who are involved in the climate effort, and they really want to see them make ambitious commitments ahead of this conference in Glasgow, Scotland.
Alarm bells have been ringing for years now on the issue of climate change. Do you think anybody's listening, and do you think member countries are in the mood right now to do something based on all the alarming reports that are coming out?
Well, I think people are listening. I think governments are listening, and I think citizens are listening, because you can't really ignore it anymore. One of the major things that we're seeing are a huge increase in extreme weather events across the planet, be it cyclones, floods, drought, hurricanes. They're really, really impacting countries everywhere. And we either need to get this under control or we're all going to be dead. So there's definitely an acknowledgement by governments that something needs to be done. But the point is to shake all the money out of them, to get them to do it, and to get that political will where it needs to be to get it done quickly. But the UN Secretary General is always very quick to point out that it's not just you have to do things that hurt, take measures that pinch, like give money and things like that, or cut back on coal or fossil fuel use. He points out that you can make money, you can improve your economy by greening them. And that's another big element of his climate action agenda, is to promote things like investment in solar power, in wind energy, in different ways that electric cars and all sorts of things that can improve our planet. But, you know, hey, they're going to do something for you as a government and as a private sector business.
That's VOA's UN correspondent Margaret Bashir speaking with me from New York. The extremist Islamic State group has claimed responsibility for a series of deadly bombing targeting Taliban vehicles in eastern Afghanistan. The claim, published late Sunday on the militant group's media arm, the Amaq News Agency, signals a growing threat to the Taliban by their longtime rivals. At least 8 people were killed in the attacks on Sunday and Saturday in the provincial city of Jalalabad, an ISIS stronghold. The Taliban seized control of Afghanistan last month, overrunning the capital of Kabul, while U.S. and NATO troops were in the final phase of withdrawing their troops. The Taliban now faces major economic and security challenges in trying to govern Afghanistan, and an accelerated campaign of IS attacks will further complicate those efforts. Both groups subscribe to harsh interpretation of Islam, but the Taliban have focused on taking control of Afghanistan, while IS affiliates in Afghanistan and elsewhere call for global jihad. In the past few weeks, the U.S. has evacuated more than 800,000 people from Afghanistan, including U.S. citizens and Afghan refugees. To help newcomers from Afghanistan resettle in America, Fatima Popar started collecting donations in her Washington, D.C. restaurant. Katrina Bafrazian has the story.
The owners of this Washington, D.C. restaurant called Lapis have spent the last few weeks collecting donations for Afghan refugees that were evacuated to the United States. Wine shelves hold hundreds of boxes full of everything from clothing and personal hygiene items to dinnerware and cleaning supplies. The person behind this makeshift donation center is Fatima Popal, the owner of a number of DC restaurants. She says her desire to help the refugees stems, among other reasons, from personal history.
We are also refugees from a different time period of war in Afghanistan, so we do understand how most of these refugees feel. Of course, our time period is a little bit different, where it wasn't the Taliban regime, but...
Popal's family left Afghanistan in the 1980s when Fatima was just 6 months old. They have been living in the U.S. since 1987 and today own 3 restaurants in the U.S. capital. She decided to spread the word about the donation center on social networks and was flooded with gratitude and responses.
Both my brother and I woke up with just a social media blast of just people just wanting to help. Not only to donate, but also to help their time, help with giving in their time and volunteering their time for us. And it's just been just beautiful to see how the community has come together, how everyone just wants to help and donate.
Receiving the donations, sorting through them, filling up trucks with the necessary items, and then doing it all over again. This is what Popal and dozens of volunteers have been doing since. A lot of business owners in the Washington, D.C. area are collecting donations for the Afghan refugees. Both small businesses and giants like Airbnb that promised to provide 20,000 Afghan refugees with free accommodations around the world. A myriad of charity organizations in the U.S. have also volunteered to do what they can to help. Catholic Charities, located in Virginia, is one of them.
What we have here is just one day's worth of donations. Amazon drivers were dropping them off truckload after truckload, all donated.
Stephen Caratini, CEO of Catholic Charities in Arlington, Virginia, says the numbers of Afghan refugees are quickly rising.
We obviously think that that's going to continue to be an increasing number over the next few months and even years. When they come to this country, we're the first, usually the first faces that they see. We meet them at the airport. And then things happen very, very quickly after that. The priority is to help these families into housing, find permanent housing as quickly as possible, and then also begin the search for employment.
Volunteers, on top of physical help, don't forget about psychological help as well. They keep in touch with the refugees, help with advice, help them calm down. No one wants to leave their home country like that, says Fatima Papal. But if they have to, she adds, the least others can do is to help the refugees find a second home in the U.S. Karina Befredjian for VOA News, Washington.
A court in Rwanda has found the man who inspired the film, quote, Hotel Rwanda, unquote, Paul Rusesabagina, guilty of terror-related offenses. He was charged along with 20 other people. The ruling comes more than a year after Rusesabagina disappeared during a visit to Dubai and appeared days later in Rwanda in handcuffs. He was accused of supporting the armed wing of his opposition political platform, the Rwanda Movement for Democratic Change. The armed group, the National Liberation Front, had claimed some responsibility for attacks in 2018 and 2019 in the south of the country, in which 9 Rwandans died. Rusesabagina has maintained his innocence, and his family alleges he was kidnapped and taken to Rwanda against his will. Rwanda's government has asserted that he was going to Burundi to coordinate with armed groups based there and in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Rusesabagina is credited with saving more than 1,000 people by sheltering them at the hotel he managed during the 1994 genocide in Rwanda, in which more than 800,000 Tutsis and Hutus who tried to protect them were killed. Rusesabagina, a Belgian citizen and U.S. resident, has asserted that his arrest was in response to his criticism of long-time Rwandan President Paul Kagame over alleged human rights abuses. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. The Abraham Accords between Israel and some Arab countries, brokered by former President Donald Trump, are now a year old. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken recently held an online event with officials from Morocco, Bahrain, the UAE, and Israel to celebrate the anniversary of normalized relations. VOA senior analyst Mohammed Elshenawi has the details.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken marked the first anniversary of the signing of the Abraham Accords last week with a half-hour video celebration with Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid, his Moroccan counterpart Nasser Bourita, the United Arab Emirates diplomatic advisor to the Foreign Minister Anwar Gargash, and Bahrain's ambassador to the United States Abdullah Al-Khalifa. Secretary Blinken praised the Accords and their results.
We're seeing growing people-to-people ties, even with the serious challenges posed by the COVID-19 pandemic. Diplomatic relations have made it possible to fly between Israel and Bahrain, Israel and Morocco, and Israel and the United Arab Emirates. Some of these flights have never been allowed before.
Blinken said the deepening diplomatic relations provided a foundation to tackle challenges that demand international cooperation, such as reducing regional tensions, combating terrorism, and mitigating the impact of the climate change. Blinken also linked the Abraham Accords to the challenge of reaching a peaceful settlement to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict.
We all must build on these relationships and growing normalization to make tangible improvements in the lives of Palestinians and to make progress toward the long-standing goal of advancing a negotiated peace between Israelis and Palestinians. Palestinians and Israelis deserve equal measures of freedom, security, opportunity, and dignity.
The participants avoided mentioning former President Donald Trump or former Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who pushed hard to bring about the accords and opened up diplomatic ties after decades of resistance. Moroccan Foreign Minister Nasser Bourita emphasized the fact that Morocco's relationship with Israel preceded the Abraham Accords by a few decades. He added that there is a need for a new regional order where Israel is a stakeholder and no longer an outsider in its own region. However, Bourita stressed the need for a peace agreement between Israel and the Palestinians.
Morocco believes that there is no other alternative to a two-state solution with an independent Palestinian state within borders of June 67. Besides, and for His Majesty King Mohammed VI, Chairman of Al-Quds Committee, the status of Jerusalem has to be preserved as a common heritage of humanity, as a symbol of peaceful coexistence of the followers of the three monotheistic religions.
Bourita said, Morocco has always played a significant, still discreet role in facilitating peace in the past and is ready to pursue this role today. Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid said the Abraham Accords Club is open for new members as well to join in the new era of cooperation and friendship. While avoiding any mention of relaunching the Israeli-Palestinian peace talks, Lapid discussed his government's effort to help some Palestinians. Mohammed El-Shinawi, VOA News, Washington.
Greece has opened a new migrant holding camp to ease long-standing overcrowding conditions that even authorities have called a disgrace. Humanitarian organizations and migration advocates called the European Union-funded project an, quote, audacious, unquote, example of Europe's reluctance to effectively address illegal migration, especially considering a new surge of Afghan migrants anticipated in the aftermath of the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan. Anthi Karasava reports from Athens.
Speaking against the backdrop of the new camp, with its soaring fence and barbed wire, Migration Minister Notis Mitarakis said the facility on the island of Samos would provide asylum seekers a safer, more humane stay.
We're now implementing a new model in the camps, these closed control centers, which provide, on the one hand, much better living conditions, a lot more space for each asylum seeker with all the necessary facilities and the kind of standard of living that you would expect from a European Union country, but at the same time increase security provisions for the benefit of asylum seekers, of the benefit of the staff, and of the benefit of the local communities.
The new facility costs about $50 million and is largely being funded by the European Union. It will house up to 3,000 people, with the first batch of some 550 refugees scheduled to move in on Monday, moving out from an older camp critics have long decried as among the worst on the continent for being overcrowded and filthy, with little access to bathrooms and hot water. Rimmed with barbed wire fencing, surveillance cameras, X-ray scanners and magnetic doors, and tucked away miles in the rugged highlands of Samos, the new camp, say human rights advocates and aid workers, looks less homey than authorities and the EU are making it out to be. Yorgos Karayannis of Doctors Without Borders, the aid group also known by its French acronym MSF.
For us it's a jail. It's a declaration of harmful policies that are preferred by EU leaders rather than the care, the induction and the ensure of asylum.
Just a couple of miles from the Turkish coast, Samos has been inundated with refugees since more than a million people, mainly Syrians, streamed into Europe in 2015, marking the biggest migration push since the Second World War. Four other Greek islands face similar fates, left to accommodate hundreds of thousands of people to the distress of local communities. Now the centre-right government in Athens says it will make all those camps obsolete, replacing them with new detention centres by the end of next year. In a separate statement, the MSF said the project marked a perfect illustration of how criminal the EU policy is on immigration, preferring, as MSF puts it, to hold and detain people escaping violence, punishing them for wanting to be safe. MSF billed the project a disgrace and warned that it would add to the trauma of displaced people as Europe braces for a fresh migratory push following the Taliban takeover in Afghanistan. Since coming to power, the government of Kyriakos Mitsotakis has taken a hard line on migration. While migratory flows have dropped more than 80% in recent years, largely because of the COVID-19 pandemic, the government in Athens has vowed to block any further illegal entries. Antika Rasava for VOA News, Athens, Greece.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofori in Washington. Thank you so much.